Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So we've finished the 3-month winter retreat. And so, first and foremost, the Sangha wants to thank the lay people for making this opportunity possible for us. It's an extraordinary thing to do, to be able to meditate for 3 months. And I know lay people would like to do that sometimes too, but you have responsibilities and work and so on, so you, through your kindness and support and generosity, you allow us to do this, and so we're immensely, immensely grateful. And it's an important part of our from the Ajahn Chah tradition or any meditative monastic tradition, is times of solitude. Solitary practice is different than community practice, and both are important. And Ajahn Chah was very good in creating environments where both communal activities were encouraged and times of deep solitude were encouraged, and you learn different things in those kind of two kinds of venues. So this has been a time of solitary practice, and Venerable Chunda had 3 months on his own, and Venerable Kim got a couple of months, and the Samaneras had a month or 5 weeks, and Venerable Suvijana had a month. So, and everyone used their time very, very well. We're quite a, not to show off, but we're a serious outfit. You know, we're not here to mess about, really. So I was very pleased that the kind of insights that the monks and samaneras shared in their own and their diligence in pursuing their own meditative interests and meditative techniques and such like. So I'm very pleased that way. And again, this interrelationship that we have with the laity is terribly important, because who can do this? Who can do this kind of life? But then also, who wants to do this kind of a life? You know, it's a kind of life that doesn't suit everyone. But I think the fact that people see it has value, that we can encourage samaneras to go forth and they can practice here, is something that our community can be very, very proud of in a good way. So now our own style changes to something more active. Probably for you who come from a busy work world, it doesn't feel all that active compared to what we do. But I was just thinking how you'd think, you come out of a retreat, you think everyone's sort of radiant and blissful and just oozing love, looking in each other's eyes, oh, you're such a great meditator. But actually, we're all reluctant. We're reluctant to come back to the world, because there's something about picking up complexity, picking up human relationships, picking up the interaction of the human society, which is much more different than solitude. Solitude has its challenges, and I think the pattern that most of us find is when we go in December, at the end of December, we go into a kind of solitary retreat practice, and it's different than an organized, regulated, structured retreat, solitary, because you've got the whole day, and all you've got is your mind. You might have a book or two, but you've got your mind. That's it, mate. You sort it out. So usually the first week or two, there's a lot of restlessness. You know, because going up to a retreat, it's been a very active time. Get everything done, sort stuff out, projects, people, and then bang, nothing. No computers, no telephones, no internet, no distracting literature. Just your mind. And so that takes some doing to be with oneself 24/7. The monks who are on solitary retreat, they just come, receive their meal and go back to their kutis, try not to talk to each other, and everyone's really diligent in that. Not in a neurotic way, but in a very considered way. I was pleased with that. And so go back to your kuti, what now? And it's interesting, you just watch, yeah, I want to do something, but I don't want to meditate. Or restless, or anger comes up, or fear, or lust, or whatever. And well, what do you got? Just got your mind, you got your practice. And then after a while, one works, for most people, you kind of work through that restlessness, start the mind starts to settle, start to experience some more settled kind of samadhi. Then it gets interesting, and it's much more interesting. And then it all changes, and then back into complexity. As I was, there was the bhikkhus have a lovely exercise machine now, and I'm probably going to live to be 70 because of that. So I was getting my exercise, and so I just did 30 minutes, and 30 minutes is very easy for me. So I'm doing this exercise, and within a minute I thought, I don't want to do this. Never had that feeling? I don't want to do this. And of course, what we develop as monastics is a strong sense of determination, just to ordain, or to take on like a lot of monks are doing fasting, or just to take on a certain kind of practice and do it for a month. This is the development of Adhidhana Bharami, or the perfection or the virtue of determination. So, and this is a very important part of spiritual life, is to pick up a discipline, to pick up a format which is challenging, but you know that if you work with that, you get a lot of strength. So I'm just thinking of that, the kind of exercise machine, very good example of that, where I set the clock for 30 minutes, but my mind said that 1 minute, that's enough. And then I just determined not to just do it, come, 30 minutes, I'm going to do it, come hell or high water, because that's not wisdom. But actually I thought, okay, so now I'm going to watch the feeling of not wanting to do exercise while I'm exercising. And then how long can that last? How long can not wanting to exercise last as a condition in the mind? Yeah, if I was hurting myself and it was truly painful, I could last for the 30 minutes, but it wasn't, I knew it wasn't. And just watch the sense of, I don't want to do this. But I didn't think about it. And I didn't try to distract it either. I just said, what's it really feel like not to want to do something, and how long will it last? And it didn't last that long. Can't last. Can only last if I keep feeding it with my thinking mind. And then it became neutral. I was never ecstatic. Those 30 minutes ecstasy didn't come up. It was just very neutral, kind of peaceful, and then it would come up again. And then I could see my mind negotiating, you've done 12 minutes, that's a lot. That's a lot. And then again, the same feeling, how long can I feel that 12 minutes is too much? And then that changed. And just watch it. And 30 minutes was a good meditation exercise. Good meditation. And I got a bit of a workout. And that's very much the monastic life. And I think any life which has boundaries, any life which has commitments and responsibilities, is this way of working within containment, working within limitations, working within boundaries, skillful boundaries, not things that hurt you and harm you, but moral precepts, retreat situations, responsibility in family, raising kids, responsibility at work, being with people that you have to be with, you might not want to be with. All of those are the kind of structures which, they don't bind us, they limit us. But the word religion, religio, is related to ligament. And the idea of monastic discipline is you are bound to a rule. You're bound to a discipline. You are bound to a community. But not in a way to harm you or hurt you, and not to deny you freedom, but to look at, in this bound situation, where is liberation? Where is freedom? Where is the unconditioned? Where is the transcendent? Where is the deathless? Within a situation where you cannot find freedom by changing the boundaries all the time, that's the delusion of freedom. If I change the boundaries, if I change the situation, then I'll find freedom. But that doesn't work. Desire just keeps reorganizing things into another unsatisfactory structure. So my sense of monastic life is all these forms that we have. Vinaya we have. We have seniority. We have schedules. We have disciplines. We have a certain intellectual structure that we try to get our heads around, and so on. We have solitude, we have community. These are they're the kind of things I bind myself to deliberately. I give myself that, I give up to that quite deliberately, and then I watch, as on the exercise machine, where's the suffering? Where's the problem here? And I learn how to use the boundaries actually for edification, for liberation, for becoming more understanding of myself. So now we as monastics, we enter into a period of community, and it would be extraordinary not to feel some resistance, not in a selfish way. It's not wrong to feel resistance, but just, no, I really don't want to pick up the world. I really don't want to feel emotional reactions of other people. I don't really want to dig muddy ditches. I'd rather sit on my meditation cushion. And that would be quite natural. There's nothing wrong with that. But you imagine if we just did that, if we just follow those preferences, of course, then we'd become more and more selfish, more and more resentful of responsibilities, and we'd actually become rather childish. So, using that exercise machine as a kind of metaphor, then in any situation of difficulty or conflict or resistance or whatever, to say, okay, so how long can I not like this? And to do that, you have to be quite awake. You have to be quite aware. To blame someone, that's easy. To blame someone or some situation or to complain, that's easy. That's just the mind being lost in discontent. That's not difficult. We all do that. But to actually awaken to a feeling of discontent and not judge it. Not say, oh, I've been on retreat for 3 months now, just be so grateful, shouldn't have any selfish impulses, but that's not life. Life doesn't work that way. Life works in the way of the way it works. So just being very honest about that, but binding oneself to a sense of responsibility rather than binding oneself to the negative desire patterns of consciousness. That's the trick, isn't it? So I'm on the exercise machine, or I'm doing some work, or I'm talking with someone, and I feel, I don't really like this. It was not immoral, it's just part of our life. So how long can I feel not liking? That's brilliant. That's practice. Thinking that you shouldn't feel that, or blaming the other person, not practice, it's attachment. It's attachment. Non-attachment doesn't mean that we don't feel the push and pull of negativity and so on, but we no longer are bind ourselves to that. We give ourselves up to something larger. And monastic life is that. It's something that it's not designed by me or Ajahn Sumedho or even Ajahn Chah. It's something that's been going on for 2,500 years. This particular slant for monasticism, kind of coming from Ajahn Chah, and then our take on it, our Western take on it, it has its own slant, but it's not designed through the ego desire patterns of one person. Right? It's a kind of communal agreement coming down from tradition and heritage. So it's something that one can give oneself to, one can give up to. And then that's where the freedom lies. That's where the freedom lies. Not in Like when we find that it's not the case now, but sometimes we find monks will come and they'll just try to manipulate the structures and formats that we have for their own little agendas. They suffer. Boy, they suffer. They're just always trying to get out of work or get a little time for this or do this. And they want to do their practice, which is a kind of Buddhist sickness, I think. I want to do my practice, and my practice never involves you. It never involves generosity. And we don't have that here now. But you see that sometimes, people who think that my practice is doing my thing is somehow going to get them enlightened, they just end up being actually rather miserable people, with no joy. So that the sense of like giving yourself to something, be it marriage, be it a vocation, be it just a period of serving or whatever, giving yourself to that as a vehicle for understanding yourself doesn't mean that you like it. No, it doesn't mean you like it, but you have the freedom now. Okay, I'm going to watch. I got 30 minutes. I'm just going to watch what happens. And that kind of determination isn't based on, it's not like an ego thing. I'm going to become someone who can do 30 minutes of exercise. It's much more subtle than that. It's much more wise than that. So be it marriage or family life or whatever, I mean, there's a lot of material there that you don't like. You don't like the person, you don't like the situation, you don't like the complexity, you don't like whatever. But you're in it. Now, if we don't recognize the not liking part, and we just subvert it all the time with some kind of overlay of Buddhist smarmy goodness, that won't work. That makes it even worse. Or if we blame, and those are the two extremes, where we don't recognize, we don't make conscious our resistance to something. Or we blame our resistance on someone or something. Those two extremes, repression and indulgence, will get you nowhere. It will get you into trouble. We've all been there. But the waking up to resistance, what does that point to? What does the waking up to resistance point to? It points to the fact that there is something which is not resisting, and that's awareness. And that is a transcendent. And that quality of being able to notice resistance, we don't tend to notice that. We tend to always be distracted by the resistance and our preferences. But suddenly we, you know, just doing that exercise and just seeing resistance is like this, how long will it stay? All of a sudden you notice the background. The background of consciousness is very still. It's always there. It's never gone. It's not dependent on the exercise, on the people liking or disliking. It's always there. And so the awakening to things like resistance or annoyance or jealousy or these things which we would rather not have, none of us like that. I'd much rather get on that machine and kind of, woo, this is great fun. Probably won't happen this lifetime. But that's not a very kind of mature way to look at life, is it? But if I just take the disciplines that I like, the family situations that I'm committed to, the monastic form that I'm in, and as the form changes into different types of demands or whatever, I keep awakening to their resistance to the way things are. And then I'll notice that awake mind is not resistance. Resistance points to the awake mind. That's the irony of it. Everything is pointing to peace. Everything. Your most awful, jealous, petty, horrible mind state is pointing to awareness. And the most beatific, divine sense of Krishna coming to play his flute in your ear is also pointing to awareness. This is the It's like it's so close to us, we don't notice it. We're just so caught up in the conditioned realm, caught up in our own views and opinions and our sense of even goodness. And you can be very caught up in trying to be a good monk and be very, very diligent, but feel guilty if you're not up to the mark or whatever. But everything requires awareness, requires consciousness. And So the teaching, the spiritual teaching of binding yourself to a form, to a structure, not because the binding is right, no, because by giving up to the form of the structure, you notice the deep silence of the heart, the deep silence of the mind. If you don't do that, if you don't have something to give up to, then you tend to shift the boundaries, distract the conditions, create all the time, because that's what desire does. Desire, that's what it likes to do. It likes to try to get its, or it likes to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. And we all do that. I do it when I can get away with it. You know, coffee, tea, I'll have coffee, thank you. One sugar, two sugars, four, please, or something like that. So that's what the desire mind does. You know, it's always trying to get conditions right. So if my life is just kind of predicated on always fulfilling my desires, desire for objects, it's a losing game. Sure, you get, you know, you get your four sugars in every now and then when you get diabetes or something. But giving up to something with wisdom, and then watching resistance or liking or disliking and just being the witness, all of a sudden you realize, sure, it's always here and now. Whereas desire is always tomorrow and the future. If I can get rid of this now, these conditions, and organize my life to get those other conditions, then I'll be happy. Maybe. Maybe. But I think we've all tried that. And that works. The trouble with that is, you know, it works about 10% of the time. Okay, 15 max. But the rest of the time it doesn't. And because it works 15% of the time, you think you can get it 100% of the time. You know, well, last time I almost did it. Was what the Buddha's pointing to is that pursuit of conditions through desire, that kind of desire, the desire for the conditioned realm to be pleasant all the time, is limited. It's not wrong, it's not immoral, it's just limited. And his liberation and his enlightenment are pointing to the unlimited possibility of peace, the unlimited possibility of freedom. Right? And that is not the same as a coffee with four sugars. And it's not the same as harmony in a community. It's not the same as health. It's not the same as being praised. It's not the same as getting what you want, right? Because getting what you want eventually changes to not having what you want. So the wanting of conditions the Buddha pointed to is okay. You have to understand that and you have to use that. But the knowing of unfulfilled wanting is a deeper kind of possibility of peace. And that takes determination, that takes peace, that takes wisdom, that takes a bit of burning, a bit of frustration, a bit of failure, a bit of getting banged around a bit. And that's, we've all been through that, haven't we? We've all been through that. So as we monks and samaneras enter into a more complex part of our lives, you just laugh. Complex? Lay people probably just laugh. Yeah, it's not complex, you're a dumb, I'm sorry. You don't know what complex is. But it's different. It's different. And within that, there'll be liking and disliking. There'll be things we have to do that we don't want to do. There'll be things we want to do we won't be able to do, etc., etc. And the whole point of the exercise is to begin to abide as the knowing, as the witness to change, rather than being the person that always desires things to change according to one's own preferences. It's different. It's different. So if one can fulfill one's preferences, fine. Within the moral discipline, within the resources we have, yeah, there are things that we can do. But there's a lot that we can't. Is that good or bad? It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to begin to see that the possibility of peace is not a condition in the usual sense. It's not something that you have to organize, construct, hold on to, and fear that you'll lose it. It's not that. It's just the pure awareness and pure consciousness of knowing the way things are. So peace or silence is always here. We say it's immanent and transcendent, don't we? Like when I'm on the exercise machine, and I notice the feeling of not wanting. That knowing is transcending the not wanting. It's not saying that the not wanting is there, it's just not engaging it, not attaching to it, not getting reborn into it, not believing in it, not seeing it as a permanent condition. That's what we call transcendence, knowing change. And within that transcendent observation and knowing, there is something that is always available, always imminent, always available, and that's silence. That's always there. It's not, silence is not, it's not tomorrow, it's always here now. And we don't notice it because we're so preoccupied with thought, with planning, with the past, with the future, with our habits, with our judgments, with our gadgets, you know, and so on and so forth. So the problem is not that we are bad or evil, it's the problem is preoccupation with the conditions. And we have to be preoccupied with the conditions to a certain extent. You know, you have to cook a meal and put petrol in a car and make sure the chainsaw is sharp or whatever we have to do. We have to be occupied with conditions, but do we have to always be preoccupied? Do our minds always have to be filled with thoughts and planning and worrying? No, we don't have to, but we are. And that's the work that we're doing. The work we're involved in is somehow freeing up consciousness, freeing up our attention to begin to touch the peace of the heart, to begin to notice. So it's always silent. We just stop yattering. We just stop complaining about the monks. We just stop. Just stop. And you stop. And you can listen. And you hear the wind. And you notice the silence. It's always there, isn't it? You notice it in nature more. So Venerable Kemiko was delighting in the silent sun, deep, deep silence of the winter here. He's from Arizona, right? Somewhere down there. And we have that, don't we? The deep silence of winter. But you know that deep silence of winter, it's your mind. Really, I mean, because the deep silence of winter is just pointing to your own mind. Because you can be watching through the deep silence of winter and thinking about, you know, killing your partner or something. So that's not deep silence. Deep silence is your own mind. It's the most profound place of your own mind. But because we're always externalized into objects, into conditions, into our habits, we don't turn back. And it happens, doesn't it? Like you come across a, like we had a couple of cranes nesting, not quite nesting, they were kind of dancing last year. You see these two cranes, they're supposed to be in Alberta. So what are you guys doing here? And the mind just stops. And you think, well, it's the cranes, right? So, okay, we should just start introducing cranes, and then my mind will get silent. Won't work. I'm obsessed with cranes. It's not about the cranes. It's not about out there. It's actually about my mind, and the situation happened to allow the mind to awaken to its beauty. That's all. And that's what happens with the Tsar mind. When you have meditative experiences or environmental experiences that bring you to that deep silence, you think, oh, that's the place. But it's not there. It just happened to come about because conditions were that way. It's about your own mind. It's about your own mind. So stopping, listening, knowing, these are the sort of tools of the contemplative life. Listening, waiting, being available. You know, they're not like willful, strong, sock 'em to it kind of tools. Those don't work. They just get you very tense and frustrated. But the subtlety of just waiting, listening, being available, we don't do that, do we, in our culture? Any culture, maybe. Our culture's just so busy accumulating or getting done, and you know, there's always one thing to another. And then our consciousness is, or our attention is never available to peace because it's preoccupied with the conditions. We have to do that to a certain extent. But there's much of the day, much of the time where we can just stop and be available, just by listening. And if you begin to do that a lot, begin to just break up the structures and habits of compulsive mind, compulsive thinking and worrying and so on, just break it up by thinking, what's the sound now? What's it like now? the mind goes to silence. But you have to do it a lot. You have to encourage yourself a lot. What's it like? What's this moment really like now? Without comment, without judgment. Just what's it really like to be Viradhamma sitting here now? You don't even believe Viradhamma. What's it really like? And then your mind stops. And you're not looking for an answer, because there's no answer, it changes. But just that very attentiveness and care for the moment stops the mind. When I first started meditation, I thought I had to squeeze. I thought mindfulness meant I squeezed every moment with its, what was it? It's like squeezing an orange for all its juice. I really had to be mindful and really like taste the curry, and walk real slow and really wash my bowl carefully. I hated it. An awful way to live your life. Because it was just trying to control things. It wasn't awakening. Awakening's beautiful, right? Because it's simple. It's just the simplest thing. Controlling, getting rid of, becoming is very complex. And we are, we're conditioned to be very complex beings. We have a lot of information in our heads. We have, some of us have university degrees. I don't. But... So we're very complex. And yet the awakened mind, stop. So simple. You just stop and listen. And then, as meditators, it can't be that. It has to be more than that. Start thinking, doubting. So trusting in awareness, trusting in the awake mind, and then noticing the way things are. More and more you come home. But you have to do it. You have to do it a lot. And the doing isn't necessarily like on a long retreat. It's the sort of all the time kind of practice. You're in the dental office or you're talking with someone. Just what's it like talking with this person now? It's very simple, very beautiful. So it's actually very loving in that way. Loving not in an emotional way, but it's a kind of caring attitude to the way things are. Not a demand at all. So I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayantamagataya sadhu karandadamase.
Sadhu.